My name is Jamal Cooney, and I am at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. I am doing a Zoom interview with Thomas Price, who is in Rivershell, New York. Today's date is Tuesday, October 26, 2021, and this is an interview for the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Project. Hello, Tom. Is it okay if I call you Tom?
It's okay.
Thank you for joining me today. First, I'd like to learn a little bit about your childhood, things such as where you were born, what is the name of your parents, and how was it growing up in your neighborhood?
Okay. Well, the beginning was in Clifton Forge, Virginia. And my father worked for the railroad. My mother was a housewife. He moved west, I guess, following work. And we ended up moving to Ohio, to a place called South Point, Ohio. Actually, my little village was called Burlington, Ohio. And that's where I grew up. I am an only child, but my mother had a large family. There were nine of them. So there were five brothers and sisters nearby. So I had a lot of cousins. And those cousins were, some of the guys were more like brothers, and some of the girls like sisters rather than cousins. So I grew up with a large, not in my immediate house, but a large family in the immediate area. Some of my older cousins, the guys, were kind of rock'em sock'em kind of guys. And they used to push the young guys, like me and my other cousins, a similar age around. And in fact, one of my cousins very recently, we were at something, at a funeral, and he was telling people that he made me the man I am now because when I was a kid, he used to push me around, and beat me up, and dare me to tell my mother. And I never would because he said, you're gonna be a little sissy if you go tell your mother. And so I would never cry, never tell. So he wants to take the credit for making me tough. In fact, some of them were very good athletes that I used to emulate. And I think that was helpful along the way when I started playing sports. As a kid, I was actually not really sickly, but I had asthma and kind of bad asthma. Can recall being in the emergency room a lot as a child. But as I got older, asthma became less of a problem. And as that became less of a problem, I got better at playing sports. And I guess maybe because I was a single child, I got around teammates, friends. I just loved all that interaction and loved being around, teams. Started playing sports in the fifth grade, on a basketball team. I can remember one of the disappointing days of my life was the fifth graders got to try out for the sixth grade team that was a travel team that went to play other schools. And my best friend in the fifth grade made the team. I did not. And, I was very happy for him, but very sad for me. But somewhere around the sixth grade, I started being able to play a lot better at pretty much every sport and to pretty much play every sport. My father worked for the railroad and he worked that 7 to 3 shift. So he really came to pretty much every sporting event from seventh grade on. In fact, when I was in high school, he and another group of dads who kind of all worked shift work, got off in the afternoons, came to practices. So my dad never missed two games in a row. I don't know that he ever missed two practices in a row. I mean, that was for baseball, basketball, and football. By the time I got into high school, I went to a high school that was much more adept at athletics than it was pre-academics. I was a very good student in an average high school. And I was a good athlete in a very good athletic school. So a lot of the upperclassmen were getting attention from schools, big schools who were recruiting them. And because I played as a freshman and sophomore, I got a lot of attention along the way. So, in fact, when I was a senior in high school, I was All-State and was a high school All-American in football. I signed to play at Ohio State. Willie Hayes was the famous coach there. And when they were recruiting you. They knew you could still go to other schools. In those days, you would sign a letter of intent in the conference. So I signed a Big Ten letter, but I continued to visit other schools. And I did some things that were a first. My father worked for the railroad and I'd never flown. And, you know, he said, son, we take the train for two reasons. They have not perfected flying and the train is free. In fact, when I went to Dartmouth, you know, took it, I don't know, I was like 15-hour train ride because we had to stop in New York, a long train ride to get to Hanover, actually Boston, then a bus to Hanover from Boston. But got to fly for the first time. And my first plane flight was actually from Ohio to State College, Pennsylvania to go to Penn State. And a famous coach there was Joe Paterno. And I think Coach Paterno might have had something to do with my going to Dartmouth. Went to his house and he asked, what other schools are you looking at? I said, well, in Ohio State, Kansas, Michigan, Dartmouth. He said, stop right there. I'm an Italian kid from Brooklyn that went to Brown. And we have the best combination of sports, football for you, and pre-med of any of the schools that you have mentioned, except for Dartmouth. If you don't come here, I think you should go to Dartmouth. I never forgot that. And there weren't any other coaches who spoke of any other schools in any kind of positive light. It's, you know, it's here or nowhere. This is the only place you should ever consider. But he wasn't like that. And that's why when Paterno had his problem, I was a little disappointed, because one of the reasons why he was a successful coach was that he really did look at his athletes as individuals. And he didn't look at them just as, you know, sports jocks on his campus to win, but he looked at them as young student athletes who had a future ahead of them. And that's why I think the Ivy League gets it right when it comes to student athletes, because, you know, we want to win. You know, I want to see Dartmouth win, but I also want to see, you know, those Dartmouth players go out into the world and become leaders in whatever field they choose. And I think the Ivy League does that better than anybody else. You know, I mean, I think we play, I get, you know, people would kid me and say, you go to the Ivy League to play football, when everybody thought, you know, the Big Ten was the place to be. But I knew that my future wasn't in professional sports, or, you know, but I wanted to play and I wanted to have fun. I got a picture not far from here of me and Gale Sayers. Gale Sayers was a premier athlete, a running back for the Chicago Bears at that point in time. And he went to the University of Kansas, and I went to Kansas to visit. And Kansas might have had something to do with me going to Dartmouth too. So I go there, and he's recruiting, and, you know, I mean, if the best running back in the NFL says something to you, you should come to Kansas. I say, okay. So I plan to sign the Big Eight letter of intent because of him. But the coach said, let me take you to see some of the players. And he took me to this off-campus house. And, you know, I'm a peanut butter and jelly kid from Ohio. I don't drink. I don't smoke. You know, he take me to this house. And it's like 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. And there's a party going on. And I mean, there's a lot of people in there. There were a lot of girls in there. And, you know, guys were drinking beer. Even when the coach came in, they kept drinking beer. It's like, what's going on here? And when the coach left, they fired up these funny cigarettes that smelled kind of strange. I didn't know exactly what it was. I had an idea what it was. And so I said, I don't know if this is the right place for me. The next weekend, I went to Dartmouth. And the coach was a guy named John Curtis. There were freshman teams then. You couldn't play on the varsity until sophomore. And he was the head freshman coach, and he's the guy that recruited me. I don't exactly know how I got on Dartmouth's radar. I mean, he showed up at my high school one day and, you know, said, I'd, you know, like to talk with you and maybe come by later and meet your parents. And he came by my house later. And so the next time I saw him was on campus. And, you know, we were driving around campus and he says, let me take you to meet some of the athletes. And I said, oh no, not again. I thought he's going to take me to his off-campus house. He took me to Baker Library. And we started walking around the library on a Friday afternoon. He starts introducing me to the guys on the team. And, you know, there was a guy who was quarterback. There was a guy named Hank Paulson, that name you've heard. Hank was an offensive tackle at that point in time. Hank later became chairman of Goldman Sachs and secretary of the treasury. So I'm meeting now football players in the library on a Friday, as opposed to this serious, unrestrained party on Friday. And that was much more my style and personality. I said, you know, I really like this place. I think this is going up on my list, and I can hear Joe Paterno, you know, in my head too. I was also recruited by Marshall, my high school coach, and my high school principal both went to Marshall. So I got to go to Marshall. I go to visit, and the president of the Alumni Association was a doctor. And after the game, I think it was like Kent State, maybe, Marshall, it was a Mid-American Conference then. We go to his house to have dinner, and I'm sitting there, and the phone rings, and he says, it's for you. And I take a phone call, and it's a guy named Hal Greer. Hal Greer was a Marshall alum. At that point in time, was a star with the Philadelphia 76ers. And he says, you know, Tom, you know, I'm looking forward to watching you play at Marshall. And when we come out to Cincinnati, the Cincinnati Royals was an NBA team then. And he said, we come to play the Royals, you know, why don't you come and have dinner with the team and, you know, let you meet some of the players. And I'm listening to this on the telephone. I'm getting excited. I said, this Marshall thing sounded pretty good. And then he says, hold on. And so the guy gets on the phone and says, hey, Tom, how you doing? This is Wilt Chamberlain. Said, right, Hal, we're gonna take you out to dinner, man. We're gonna have some fun. You might even catch a couple of your games when we go to Marshall. It's like, what? So I hang up the phone and it's like, I just spoke to Hal Greer. I just spoke to Will Chamberlain. Now I'm getting confused. And maybe I need to go to Marshall. The phone rings again. And you know, the doc, Dr. Hagley, Ray Hagley. Dr. Hagley says, it's for you. It's like, who was it this time? Moses? And he takes a call. And he says, this is Dr. I can't remember his name. But I'm associate dean at Georgetown Medical School. And Ray and I are best friends. We were roommates in medical school. And he has told me, you know, about how you play football and that you plan to be a doctor. And I want you to know that I understand how difficult it is to be a pre-med and play football. I want you to know that I will be watching your career at Marshall. And when it comes time for you to apply to medical school, I'm going to personally walk your application through the process. Now, I'm not listening strategically to what he is saying. He's telling me, come to Marshall, and he's going to get me into medical school. I'm thinking about, I just go to Will Chamberlain, and what's for dessert? So if I had been someone who really was a strategic thinker and understanding that it's difficult to get the medical school, I would have gone to Marshall. But I wasn't a strategic thinker. I was excited about talking to Hal Greer and Chamberlain. I was excited about the dessert. If I'd gone to Marshall, I would have been on a team where it was a plane crash and everybody, including Dr. Haley, because he was a team physician, was killed. That movie, We Are Marshall, I went to see that with my son. I guess he was about 8 years old and he knew the story. I'm sitting there and he's got a tear running down his cheek. I said, why are you crying? He says, Daddy, that could have been you. I said, but he wasn't. I said, sometimes in life, you get blessings and you don't know about them at the time, but you might learn about them 4 or 5 years later. So I've actually had a lot of blessings in my life. I guess one was that I wasn't that much of a strategic thinker when I was a senior in high school. When I got to Dartmouth, as I said, you know, my high school was, it was an average high school, and it wasn't that strong. And I think my class, I'm not sure exact numbers, but I think, you know, half of my class had gone to private school, and at least half of those had gone to boarding school. So it was a very strong class. Dartmouth was all male then. Class was about 800. And for the first time in my life, I made a C. Came home at Christmas time. My first quarter grades, C there. And my mother was not taking any prisoners. She was all over me. You're going to Dartmouth, you're making C's, you're playing football, you're chasing girls instead of going to the library. Mom, I'm playing football. I'm not chasing girls. It's an all-male school. And I'm trying. My dad was a little more reserved about it. He says, well, are you trying? I said, yeah, Dad, I'm really trying. He said, well, you know, stick with it. You know, you're going to church. My dad was a deacon in the church. I said, well, every now and then, he said, well, you should go more often. You know, go to church and then go to the library. And actually, that was my Sundays. I go get a quick breakfast at Bear Hall. I go to the white church. And I go to the library. And over a relatively short period of time, I think freshman year was a difficult year because I was playing catch up. But one thing that became clear to me, they weren't any smarter than me. They were just better prepared. And with focus and hard work, I caught up. I will tell you that I went to Mount Holyoke in 4 years, one time. And, you know, we're not, as I said, it was all male school. So road tripping to the girls' schools was a big deal. I mean, that was every weekend, you know, there were lists in the hop for signups. So you can get a, you know, you can get a ride to Holyoke, Smith, or Boston. Between playing football in the fall and pre-med courses, not labs, I made a lot of road trips. I can pretty much count the road trips I made in 4 years on one hand. I was there to get into medical school, and the rest of that stuff really didn't matter that much to me. Now, I played catch up later, but there were 4 years that were very focused for me. I knew what I wanted, and if I was going to get it, I couldn't really be distracted. I didn't come home for Thanksgiving because, you know, coming home Thanksgiving, I was going to be home for Christmas, so why bother? I stayed, you know, in a dorm, and I had to kind of modify it fast. I had pretty much juice from, like, Wednesday and maybe, you know, juice and a salad for Thanksgiving, and I slept and studied, you know, that weekend. I actually enjoyed that. I was a biology major as pre-med. I thought majoring in the science as a pre-med student was a good idea. And I really enjoyed it. Professor Ballard, one of the venerable, well-published, prominent biology professors in America at that time, was someone who used to stay very late in Gilman Hall. And I used to study there instead of in my dorm because I, again, focused better being out of my dorm and not be there. And I would be there late at night. And so was he. And he was kind of the quintessential professor from Central Casting. You know, white hair, white beard, a little disheveled, you know, but clearly a twinkle in his eye of, I know something about that. I don't know what it is. Whatever it is, I know something about that. It was kind of inspirational being around smart people like that. And it would be 12 o'clock at night, and he would be walking around, you know, in his socks. And I said, you know, you're still here? I said, well, so are you. And we would have these casual conversations. One thing I tell junior colleagues now whenever people ask me about advice, and one of those things is, to form alliances, if not even forming mentorships. Dr. Ballard wasn't a mentor, but we got to know one another well. He didn't know anything about football. I don't think he knew anything about Black people. And we discussed football, politics, race. And when it was time for me to go to medical school, I asked him for a letter of recommendation. And he said it'd be his pleasure. In fact, when I was on one of my interviews for medical school, Washington University in St. Louis, the person is interviewing me and he's to talk to me. He says, you know, young man, I have a letter here from Professor Ballard. You know, he says, it's one of the nicest letters of recommendation I've ever read. I didn't know that Dr. Ballard was going to do that. But I think the reason why he did that, because I wasn't just another face in his classroom. So I think, you know, talking to you as students, and when I'm talking to interns who are starting their careers, I ask them to identify someone who may become a mentor, but if you don't become a mentor, at least become your friend or someone that you're well acquainted with. So if there are things that they do well, you can emulate that. And at some point in time, they might be in the position to do you a favor, a letter of recommendation, or even be there to give you advice. And I was lucky enough to have Dr. Ballard. I never saw the letter, but I was happy to hear about it. When it was time, well, I haven't talked about football. I guess I should. Football's always been a big part of my life. I still love football. I mean, it's the best. They're trying to make it touch. It ain't touch. It's a violent sport. It's supposed to be
Yeah, Mr. Price, not to cut you off, but yeah, that was going to be one of my first questions about transitioning to college. Being a biology major, how did you manage with the course load while being a football player?
I will tell you that some of my best GPAs were in the fall. I think the more time you have, the more time you waste. And when I didn't have much time, I was very focused, very efficient. And there is something about having your system on peak performance. There is a mind-body connection. I'm still very physically active. It's raining and cold today. I rode my bike for 12 miles. I've always been very physically active and focused on things. And during fall, when you're up early, you're getting out early, you're working your mind and body. And I think the mental level of alertness and performance is better. I mean, even now, I have a son who, my kids didn't want to go to Dartmouth. They didn't want to, they were sick kids. Both my son and daughter both went to Penn. And they both understand the value of mind, body, and they are, my son is a runner, his knees bother him, and runner, my daughter can play anything, but she's got that kind of passion. But they, you know, they got a big exam coming up, they'll go to the gym. So my workload, you know, almost paradoxical. I don't say it was easier, but it seems that I was more efficient than before. And, you know, I think sometimes, I'll take a good call there. I think the more time I have, the more time you waste. And so I think being focused, keeping your mind sharp, and, you know, I didn't take road trips. I mean, you know, I didn't do a lot of things that a lot of other guys did. Do I talk I missed a lot? No, I don't think I missed a lot at all. I still had a lot of fun. But, you know, I mean, I think it was challenging, but, you know, clearly doable.
Okay, moving on to the next question. Did you know about the William Shockley visit to campus? If so, how did this make you feel as a Black student? And what was the reaction of the other students?
Well, it was an interesting time to be a Black student at Dartmouth. There was that not that many Black students at Dartmouth. I think when I came as a freshman, there were less than 30 Black students. Emergency room, they're gonna have to wait. They got doctors there. When I got to Dartmouth, there weren't that many Black students there, really. In fact, I can recall, freshman week, I hadn't really seen anybody else Black, and I see this Black student walking across the campus, and he was as eager to meet me as I was to meet him, and we said hello. We were both freshmen babies, and we talked about it. We were both going to be pre-med, and then he said he was our athlete, and I said, oh, me too. So what are you going to do? He says, I'm a fencer. So you're a fencer. I said, we got some different kind of brothers coming here. And I never knew anybody who ever fenced. I talked to him tonight. He's an orthopedic surgeon and does a lot of physical stuff. During the time while I was there, though, we started to recruit more students. My class, I think, had 13. The class behind me had 30. The class behind them had 80. The class behind them had 80 because Dartmouth was looking to get a 10% admission rate of 800 students. So 13, 30, 80, and 80. So now, but I'm a freshman, though, I think the total number with my 13 and all the other classmen was somewhere around 35 Black students on campus. And this guy named Wilm Shockley was coming to give a lecture. Shockley was a Nobel Prize winner. Now, if you're a Nobel Prize winner, you get a lot of credit. And sometimes you get credit for stuff that you don't deserve. They think you know a lot about everything because you know a lot about one thing. And he was really a racist and had promoted the genetic inferiority of Black people. So he came to give his presentation. He was introduced, and Black students who were there, and the majority, must have been at least 20 of us, maybe 24, stood up and started to applaud. And we didn't stop. And he wasn't able to speak. To Dartmouth's credits, nobody really had a serious problem behind that. Because they understood. There were those who said that we were suppressing speech and it should be, open exchange of ideas, even exchange you don't agree with. But somehow or another, listening to somebody tell us that we were genetically inferior just wasn't going to fly. Just wasn't going to fly. And this was also a time when, Black America was deciding, were we going to be Martin Luther King or were we going to be Malcolm X? I think at that point in time, the Dartmouth Black students were more Malcolm X than they were Martin Luther King. And in fact, while I was there, we started the African American Society. A guy by the name Woody Lee was the His name was Forrester Lee, nicknamed Woody, was the first president. And Forrester was an outstanding student. Woody was a chemistry major. And as pre-med, chemistry, organic chemistry was the weed out course. And Woody was a chemistry major and was a preceptor in the chemistry lab. So when I went to organic chemistry and I see this Black guy being one of the preceptors, he had slain the dragon. It was inspirational. So there were a lot of upperclassmen who were inspirational by their mere presence. There was a Black Rhodes Scholar in every class ahead of me, in my class, and a class behind me. You mentioned Willie Bogan is going to be interviewed as part of this project. Willie was a Rhodes Scholar. So there were some intellectual, very bright Black students at Dartmouth. And quote unquote, affirmative action really hadn't started yet. It didn't really start until the second class after me. They started recruiting people and, like people were saying that maybe the standards were being changed to get more Black students in. I don't think so. I think, there was an appreciation for some of these students didn't have as much preparation. So the scores may not have been higher, as high, but they were just as intelligent, just as bright. Put them in that setting and they will excel. And that's really what happened. It was a great time to be at Dartmouth, to see all of these smart Black people around you who were very capable and who were going to excel at what they did. I helped recruit, you know, some of the football players to come. And when I was a freshman, Blackman called me and said, you know, I got this blue chipper coming up from Baltimore, Tom. And he was just at Yale and he stayed with Calvin Hill. Now, you probably know about Grant Hill, famous basketball player. His daddy, Calvin Hill, was a great football player. You know, rookie of the year, played with the Dallas Cowboys, was an outstanding player at Yale from Baltimore. So Stu was from Baltimore. He stayed with Calvin Hill when he came to Dartmouth. I said, you know, Stu, Coach Blackman knows you went to Yale last weekend. I got nothing bad to say about Yale. I got nothing bad to say about Calvin Hill. But if you go to Yale, we're going to kick your butt every year. Came to Dartmouth. We became roommates. So he was a class behind me. I'm 71. He was 70. When he was 70, he was captain of the team. Went to Harvard Law School, finished that. Became a federal prosecuting attorney, was the district attorney in Baltimore. I guess they call it the state's attorney in Baltimore when Kurt Smoke was the Black mayor. And he ran for lieutenant governor. Those were the kind of people who were at Dartmouth then. It was very stimulating.
Mr. Price, can I ask you this? As a Black male in the late 60s, early 70s, being at Dartmouth, how difficult was it being at a higher level education school, predominantly white, located in the middle of nowhere or the middle of woods? Did you have resources to help you get through your time here, like support resources or mental health resources, or even African-American resources like we have today, such as the DBSAA, Dartmouth Black Students Athlete Alliance?
Well, no, we did not have any formal support organizations. That we were supportive of one another. I think when you're in a situation where, you know, it's kind of like football double session, you're tired, you're beat down, but you have similar goals. You don't want to forge a winner. And I think, the Black students who were at Dartmouth and with me were all there who understood that, yes, we know we're going to New Hampshire. We know it's going to be cold. We know there aren't a lot of Black people. But, you know, we're coming here to get an education because we've been told that the Ivy League education, Dartmouth education, is one that will help us get a substantial head start in life. And I do think the Ivy League education is added value. I think there are no bad colleges, none. But I do think Ivy League schools have the resources. Ivy League schools have the networks that can be helpful when you finish. Even now, if I go someplace and people talk about where they went to school, and I say Dartmouth, I see people's opinion immediately assume I'm a smart guy. Having an Ivy League diploma will help get you in the door. It won't keep you there. But I think it does help to open a door. When we were there because we wanted to get the best education we could, because we understood the value of education. We understood the value of a very good education. And we knew you'd get a very good education at Dartmouth. Our support net was our Black classmates. We did have a sort of corner table in the dining hall where nobody kind of sat because it was where Black guys sat. And, you know, most of my good friends were Black guys, but I had a number of friends who were not Black, who were in my dorms, and of course, some of my teammates. But this was the late 60s and early 70s. And we really had parallel social existences. I mean, I can't recall being in one white teammate's dorm room. Not one. That's okay. I played on one of them, not on one. I think the best team Dartmouth ever had. Fall of 1970 team was undefeated. We shut out six opponents. We were number one in the nation in total defense. We were number 12 in one poll, number 13 in another poll, AP Division I. There were some players on that team. And interestingly, I've gotten a lot closer to those guys after graduation than I did when we were teammates. We played together. We were great friends. We were friends, but we didn't have a lot of social interaction off the field. My social interactions with my teammates after graduation has been something that's been very rewarding. And I look forward to talking to them. I didn't make it to the recent homecoming where they actually celebrated the 50th anniversary. I can't believe the 50th anniversary of that team. But we were pretty much our own support group. And we understood that we were going to the northern woods of Hampshire where it was cold. So nobody acted surprised when we got there and it was cold. Nobody acted surprised when we got there. And there were no Black professors. There were Errol Hill, who came while we were there. It was one of the first, I think maybe the first Black professor there. I think Errol Hill. But it was a time where, just like, I don't want to say we're in a war, it wasn't a war, but let's say we're in a situation where you have a common struggle, common goal, you forge bonds. And some of those people that I was in college with now, some of my best friends, you know, decades later, because of our trials and tribulations on the Hanover plane.
Okay, Mr. Price, being on that 1970 Dartmouth football team, did that year of football build character in you as a young man? Are there characteristics you've learned then that you use today? Also, I have to ask, what were you guys' chances of beating Penn State?
Let me answer that first. We kicked their butt. Because we had players at every position and depth at every. Blackman had recruited nationally. And there were guys who had gone to, who were going to go to Texas, who were going to go to UCLA. You know, it turns out that my senior year wasn't the year I planned on. I ended up between that 2 weeks before camp started, I tore a cartilage in my knee. So I played my senior year hurt. I got a game ball, you know, but I wasn't all anything. Because I'm hopping around. If you got close to me, I would tackle you. But I didn't have the mobility that was one of my strengths. So I didn't have a great year. I had a whole lot of fun and had some very good games. And it was a very memorable experience. There was nothing like walking into somebody's stadium and knowing there was nothing they could do to win. Nothing. We're just going to win. I mean, we played at Yale Bowl with 70,000 people. The score was 10 to nothing because our offense kept folding inside. They kept losing the ball inside of 30. I mean, there should have been four touchdowns that maybe it should have been like, you know, 35 to nothing, but it wasn't. There's nothing like going into Harvard Stadium and making that place quiet. I can't tell you how much fun that is. And I remember it like it was a couple of years ago. Because it was, you remember the real fun days in life. And my senior year playing Dartmouth football, you know, was one of the most memorable years of my life. And some of those guys I played with, you know, black and white, you know, are some of my best friends, you know, even now. Football and sports in general are lessons in living. Preparation, you know, if you want to do something well, you got to prepare. And, you know, practice, the way you practice is the way you play. I enjoyed practice because it was, so we're still playing. We're still doing stuff. And you got to learn how to enjoy the process. You got to enjoy the preparation. It's not always going to be fun. That's why work is called work and not play. Because it's hard. It requires some effort. But you got to learn how to, you know, enjoy the effort. So football teaches you about preparation. Football and sports teach you about playing when you are injured. I mean, you know, there aren't going to be optimal circumstances every time for you in your life. Sometimes you're going to physically not feel like going to work, but you got to go to work, you know. And then there are times when, you know, you get a bad call, but you don't give up. You keep playing the game. There'll be sometimes at work, somebody's going to treat you unfairly. You're going to take your ball and go home. You're going to quit your job. You're going to figure out what to do. What you're not going to do is make it easy for them. You have an opponent that you want to beat. You're not going to lay down. You're going to play hard. And you do want to know your opposition. I mean, if you have a job, what are your expectations, your scouting report? What are their expectations here? Are you going to be able to deliver on that? Teamwork, you know, being able to work with people that you know and people that you don't know, or working with people you don't even like. Now, there was nobody on that football team I didn't like. But I will tell you, sometimes now, you know, cardiologists aren't all likable. Sometimes they're very egotistical maniacs. I can name two cardiologists that I don't like, but I can work with them because I have to. So I think sports and football in particular, because football is so physical, and there are times when you do have, you know, physical complaints and pain that you really do have to play through. It does translate into other areas of your life, which I think have been very beneficial to me.
Okay. I like to transition to life after Dartmouth. Are there a lot of relationships that you created at Dartmouth that are still around today? And also, do you still stay in contact with many of your close friends from college?
Well, let me say, after Dartmouth, I went to medical school. I got into Dartmouth Medical School, but I was ready to get out of Hanover. As I said, I'm from Ohio. The University of Cincinnati, who are playing football right now, the University of Cincinnati gave me the most money, so that's why I went. And it was kind of like Dartmouth in that there weren't a lot of Black people. The class was 125 Black students in my class. And during that 4-year tenure, when we were moving from the classroom to the hospital, that is between the second and third year, there was this preceptorship where they would teach you about physical diagnosis and things you had to do on the wards. And there was a preceptor who had, I guess, 12 students. And one of the other Black students just happened to be in that group. And I can remember the preceptor. He says, "Some people got into medical school and don't deserve to be here. I'm going to find out who they are, and I'm going to do my best to see that they don't get out." So afterwards, my friend said to me, he says, "You think he was talking to us?" I said, "He might have been talking to you, but he wasn't talking to me." I will tell you that following me, with all due modesty, there was a guy from Dartmouth in every class for a number of years. I think they thought Dartmouth guys were going to come there and work hard. I just happened to be the first, and they did. So I think my Dartmouth preparation in terms of academics, you know, left me in very good stead. I think the kind of focus and attitude that Dartmouth gave me, I think outlook affects outcome. The way on the football team, I thought there was nothing that you could do to beat us. Coming from Dartmouth academically, I didn't think there wasn't any place where I couldn't compete. So I left Dartmouth with a great deal of confidence that did help me in medical school and afterwards. Many of the bonds that I forged at Dartmouth with classmates, I continue. You know, as I mentioned, Willie Bogan and I, you know, talk often, not as often as I would like. Stu Sims, the guy that I talked about before, who, you know, was the football captain and governor of Maryland, you know, we talk often. Some of the guys in the class behind me, you know, Ben Wilson, who's Russell Wilson's uncle, you know, we're in contact often. So a lot of the guys, I said guys, but there were no women. A lot of the guys that I was with at Dartmouth, you know, I continued to be great friends with. Dan Radakovich. It wasn't fun. But Dan Radakovich was this hard-nosed offensive tackle who could hang with the brothers. In fact, he is a defense attorney in Chicago, and he does criminal defense. And we've talked about how the criminal justice system is biased against Black people. And he's seen that his whole career, and how he is very adamant and aggressive about defending Black people, even when they're guilty. They need a fair outcome. There are guys like that who were at Dartmouth then, Black and white, that I am proud to call my friends.
Nice. And a final question to wrap up the interview. Knowing what you know now, Mr. Price, what would you have done differently in college?
Oh, I've never thought about that. Maybe I take more road trips.
That's fun.
I might have done that. I might take a remote road trip. Maybe I think I overestimated how hard I had to study. So I would take more road trips. That's a definite. I might have taken a term abroad. I did not do that. And that guy who was the fencer, you know, he took a year in France. He's an orthopedic surgeon now. He speaks fluent French. He's in touch with the family even now. They stayed with them. So I think I would have taken advantage of foreign study. And I think I would have taken a few more road trips.
Yeah, we do that now, actually. We like, as students, we take a lot of road trips, whether it's to Boston, Vermont, somewhere else in Massachusetts. Yeah, we actually take a lot of road trips because we feel like it's better for the mental. Because being in Hanover for so long, doing this heavy course load, the weather's starting to get cold, you feel like you're bored and stuff. Yeah, you feel like the road trips are very necessary.
I understand that. And, you know, I took a road trip, and I guess my friend Stu and I, we rented a car one time and went to Boston, and you know, we were trying to find the shortest route so we wouldn't add up extra miles to have to pay for those extra miles in the rental car. Shortest line between, you know, two points, a straight line. We were trying to do a straight line to Boston because you wanted to save every nickel. So I understand the essential road tripping thing. I think if you do go to Dartmouth, you know, an evolution of things, I think road tripping may be even more essential now than it was then.
Can I ask you one more thing about college?
Yeah.
I would just like to know, where did the student population mostly eat back then? Was it 53 commons, or you guys had something different?
Actually, it dropped out a little bit. Can you repeat that?
Oh, I was going to say, where did the student population mostly eat back then? Was it at the place called 53 Commons that the students know today of Foco?
I don't know. I think it's changed now. There was a Thayer dining hall. And that might be where 53 Commons is now. But you know, there was Thayer dining hall. And in fact, it's part of my scholarship. I worked in the dining hall for 2 years. You know, I didn't do it during football season, but the winter and the spring, and I worked in a dining hall. And so most of the students ate in a dining hall on campus. The upperclassmen, many of whom, you know, I have a large amount of, would eat at some of the places on Main Street. But the dining hall then was Thayer Dining Hall, was where most people ate at one time.
Oh, okay, okay, yeah. 53 comments. It's like to the southwest part of the green. And it's like behind the I'm trying to see what buildings it's behind.
It's behind the administration building?
Oh yeah, it's behind the administration building.
That was Thayer Hall when I was.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
That's was the dining facility there. Yeah. So I pretty much I ate there for 3 years. My senior year, I did not have a dining contract, a dining player hall contract. Mm-hmm. And I pretty much, because I'd eat 3 meals every day. So, you know, I pretty much ate along Main Street, you know, not necessarily a balanced diet, but it was tasty.
Questions just keep coming up. One more question, going back to college. So being that everything on the outside world was going on at the time, such as like the civil rights movement, things were like a lot of Black activists. Did this affect many Black people on campus, like many Black students on Dartmouth campus back then?
Well, you know, Martin Luther King got assassinated. You know, Bobby Kennedy got killed, Kent State happened, the Vietnam War. There was just so much happening in so many places. And there was no way that you couldn't be involved with that. What we had, though, I think, at Dartmouth at that point in time, was a student body that was very politically active. Kennedy became president, and he was very socially engaged. I mean, we started African American Society. We sent 10 demands. He sent back 15 responses. Like, when Kent State happened, canceled classes. I mean, I think there was this social responsibility that Dartmouth felt to educate the students outside of the classroom as well. And so it was one of those things where Black students and white students, it was almost impossible not to be somehow socially engaged and socially involved with the issues that were happening off campus. I can remember that there was this caricature person who came to Dartmouth. And at that point in time, the general who was sort of running the war in Vietnam was General Westmoreland. And this guy came with these eagles and this uniform, and he was General Westmoreland. And he led these demonstrations with the Students for a Democratic Society and sort of anti-war rally. So there was anti-war, there was anti-discrimination. So there was all of this political activism and energy that was around, where it was impossible not to get at least tangentially involved. You know, as a pre-med student who was in the library, the gym, or the dining hall, or asleep, I wasn't as politically active as some of my classmates, but I certainly was involved and very sympathetic and supportive of whatever my more active classmates were doing.
Oh, nice. And that concludes our interview, Mr. Price. Sincerely, thank you for your time.
It's been my pleasure. It's been great talking with you. You know, Dartmouth, of course, is a place that's near and dear to my heart. Dartmouth students are people near and dear to my heart. And you really do belong to a very special club. I mean, as you travel around the world and you meet Dartmouth alumni, there is a connection there that certainly among all Black Dartmouth alums, and even among many white Dartmouth alums, that you will feel a kinship because of your time in Hanover. So there's no place that's a perfect existence. I mean, no place. You know? There are things about Hanover that I'm sure you would change. And there are times that you think you might want to be someplace else. I'm going to say wherever you go, there are things you want to change. I think the time you spend in Hanover, New Hampshire is well spent. So thank you for inviting me to talk to you. And I want to wish you all well and go big green.